So the topic today is the third and fourth factors of liberative dependent arising. Is the volume okay for everyone? You can hear? Yeah? So, and the third and fourth are gladness and delight. You managed to get through suffering yesterday. And now we're at gladness and delight. And liberative dependent origination is a version of the Buddha's teachings on dependent arising, dependent origination, conditioned arising, which is a teaching that emphasizes how when something comes into existence, it comes into existence because of other conditions, preceding conditions. And the Buddha seemed to have been reluctant of talking about the causes of things. But he talked a lot about conditions for things. And that if we want to become the custodians of our own hearts, custodians of our practice, we have to know something about the conditions we should put in place to allow the heart to grow, to allow the mind to come to freedom. And also understand the conditions that bring about our suffering, bring about our distress and despair and stress that we have. And so part of the function of mindfulness is to begin to appreciate that there are conditions and the conditions are impactful, and to be careful and caring about the conditions we put in place and the ways in which we allow conditions to influence us. If we understand how certain things influence us in negative ways, we behave inappropriately or think inappropriate in ways that are painful, it's good to make that connection so we learn to separate those two out so that we can have the conditions which are difficult and we don't then lead to us thinking, acting, feeling ways which are harmful. So I think an example would be a common idea that if people are tired, hungry, thirsty, and stressed out, that's a particular condition that you can find yourself in. It's a condition where you're more likely to be irritated by what people say and do, more likely to be overwhelmed by conditions and then pull in maybe. And it's reasonable that those conditions create those impact on us. But it's not a necessary connection. And as mindfulness gets stronger, we can start seeing, oh, these are the conditions. I am really tired and hungry. I better be careful. And I still, to this day, I have to notice that about myself, because if I come home at 5 o'clock and I am hungry and tired, and our custom is to have dinner at 5 o'clock at home, but if dinner is not ready, it's a time for extra mindfulness. So that I don't get grumpy or some other exciting thing. Just stay mindful and careful and, do the right things that are needed. So to understand the conditions that are, how conditions affect us is very, very important. And the same thing works in the other direction in terms of there can be favorable conditions that are supportive for favorable outcomes. So if we're rested, if we're fed, if we feel safe and comfortable and not stressed out, those are conditions for wisdom, for compassion, for empathy, for all kinds of other things to have a chance to come out. The mind is not crowded with reactivity, and so there's more space and time. And so to be the custodian of our lives, we want to kind of take into account conditions and the impact conditions can have on us. I think what's nice about avoiding causal language is that then we don't get, it's not a one-to-one correlation, it's not like a necessary connection. And that our psychological life, the way it unfolds, it's not a slave or a victim, necessarily so to the conditions of our lives. And so by avoiding causal language, there's actually more freedom for us to step in between conditions and consequence, or conditions and what happens next. Whereas causal, maybe it's harder to see that gap that we can operate in. And so liberative dependent origination talks about conditions that support the movement, or involves the movement towards liberation, each thing a condition for the next. And since it's not a necessary cause, but a condition, sometimes conditions kind of come together in such a way that something else arises that's not necessarily our doing, and sometimes we have to have our role in it as well. And liberative dependent origination has both. And it's quite remarkable to be practicing going, mindfulness going strong, and begin feeling things kind of starting to come into place, changes start happening within us that we can't exactly say that we caused, but we've created the conditions for it. And so it's really fun to watch these conditions arise and watch ourselves change and things happen. And but also we participate by adding some of those conditions as well. So Adrian talked about the first two factors of liberative conditioned arising, dependent arising, and they are suffering and faith. And as we've talked about, the reason suffering is first is because the primary purpose of liberation is to become free of suffering. And so we want to start there. You know, it's kind of, if you have a illness, you want to start there with, in terms of looking for the cure. If you go to the doctor with a sore throat and the doctor is not interested in your sore throat whatsoever and is more interested in, you know, I don't know, the wart on your big toe. I mean, like, you know, I've had this wart my whole life, and why are you so fascinated in that? I have a sore throat and I can't speak, and can't we get on to the subject at hand? And so if you want to be free of suffering, you want to start there. And it's not meant to be depressive, it's meant to be the beginning of the cure, in a sense. And then with that as a condition, then you can have faith in the practice, the teachings, the path that leads to the end of suffering. It's probably a little bit hard to have really honest, informed faith, confidence, unless you have some direct connection to suffering. You know, you've never suffered whatsoever ever in your life. And, you know, you read a book about Buddhism and you say, oh yeah, this path to the end of suffering, it must be really good. I think I have faith in it, but I'm not sure what they're talking about. Suffering, what's that? So anyway, so it's a condition for the particular kind of faith, particular kind of confidence. And that confidence then becomes a condition for the rising of gladness and the gladness for joy. And confidence is closely connected to inspiration. Faith is closely to inspiration, to be inspired. It's what kind of helps our hearts sing. I think of confidence or faith or trust as closely connected to the ability to say yes. To yes. And the gesture for the practicing yes would be like this. Yes. Not no. You know, yes. Step forward into it. And this idea that our life is trustable if we practice mindfulness, that there's something about mindfulness that allows us to find how things are workable, how we can find our way, or there is a way to be found by being mindful. Many times in my life I haven't known the way forward, but I've practiced mindfulness. And there's something about the careful attention, the honesty that mindfulness is, that something, the alchemy of it, something begins opening or clarifying that I could never could have planned it ahead. And so I've learned to trust the act of mindfulness. And the mindfulness and with confidence is kind of like saying yes, opening up, not to condone things, not to say, you know, great, you know, more suffering, but rather to avoid saying, avoid closing down, avoid shutting down, avoid resisting, but rather kind of in the heart or in the field of awareness, being willing with awareness to step forward to be more fully aware of something. It doesn't mean we allow it to continue to exist if it needs to be stopped, but awareness doesn't close down. And so when we sit and practice on retreat, sit and meditate, it's a great laboratory, it's a great place to begin learning to say this kind of very simple yes to whatever's happening. Because unless the building is burning down and you're sitting here, most things, you know, you don't have to, there's not required your awareness to contract or close down, doesn't require your heart to get hard and closed. And what's actually healthier is meeting it with a kind of yes, like this. And occasionally the yes leads to a changing circumstances, changing what's going on. But do we start with this yes, and so we can study it and learn, see what's there? So that's what I associate confidence with this ability to meet our experience with a kind of yes. Now, in order to move through these 12 stages of liberative dependent origination, we need to be practicing mindfulness in particular. So it means kind of showing up and being honest and seeing what's here, and really what's here in the moment. And there has to be some kind of constancy in that, a continuity of practice. And that's one of the great kind of conditions in the background of all the path, is continuity of practice, to keep showing up, keep doing it. And the image I have for that is that of a boat moving through the water. And the boat is held steady, perhaps it's heading someplace, sees the lighthouse in the distance and it's heading for there. And as the boat, as they say, it cuts through the water with the bow, it cuts through the water, and the water kind of just washes off the hull of the boat to the side and is left behind. The pilot of the boat doesn't stop to look at the individual drops of water that are coming by. Like, oh, let's go back and look at that one again. You know, let's get involved in that. Let's pick this, slow down. We want to stop and get that piece of water. You just let it go. And you just hold steady on your course. And so there's something about the practice of mindfulness and concentration and meditation where you hold the course and we let everything that arises just kind of wash off the sides. Keep steady. And there's a variety of things which are the course that we head for. If you're practicing primarily meditation on the breath, you hold your course in the breath and let everything else kind of, for the most part, just kind of wash off. So you have whatever you're thinking about, just it washes off. And the idea of washing off means that you're not in opposition to it or resisting it or against it. You just don't get involved. You just let it come by. Walk by. The thought comes up, it just washes off. Thought comes up, washes off. And so holding it steady. Or if the course you're heading is being in the present moment, then you meet the present moment every moment, this moment, and then this moment, and this moment. And whatever has arisen in the moment, you're allowed to just kind of recede to the side, back of the boat, so you can be there for the next moment. If you're involved in retrospective thinking, meaning that something has occurred, and then you stop to think about it and reflect on it and the meaning of it and what you should do about it, sometimes that's important to do. But in terms of holding steady in the course, you've kind of stopped your boat and gone back and, you know, trying to find that drop of water that seemed really interesting and trying to do something with it. And so you're no longer heading the course. And so to stay in the present moment, and whatever arises, kind of just let it wash by, let it wash through, so you're there for the next one. And next one. No retrospective thinking. Just be with it for the next one. And that continuity of practice is quite powerful because it's an antidote to the strong tendencies we have to think about things. And I'm a great fan of thinking. I'm a very friendly relationship to my thoughts. However, I know that thinking can be deadly as well. A very difficult the way we think. And a lot of the stress we have in life has to do with the thoughts that we have and how the impact those thoughts have on us and how we believe in them or invest in them or pick them up like the big boulder that Adrian talked about. They're so heavy, some of these thoughts, and we go around with this burden. And so to learn to break the habit of being swept up in thought over and over again is a very powerful thing, because then the thoughts don't have as much control over us. We have more choice about what thoughts to be involved in, how we relate to them. But if the thoughts kind of, you know, are flowing in, then to use a kind of similar boat analogy of the Buddha, it's like your boat has sprung a leak, and it's going to fill up, and you're going to, you know, the boat's going to sink, because these thoughts kind of come pouring in. It can be overwhelming at times, the thoughts we have. And so part of what we're doing, the continuity of practice, is certainly we wander off in thought, but to come back to the breath, come back to the present moment, as a way of beginning to weaken the link between us and thinking. And so we can have a thought kind of arise, and it's not an automatic linkage. It's not like we automatically hook into it. We don't automatically feel like we pick it up, or we don't even think we pick it up. It just, you know, picks us up, and we're just in it, and, you know, off we're galloping and some thought and concern we have. And so every time we come back to the breath, every time we let go of our thoughts, we're beginning to decondition ourselves from this strong linkage between thinking and ourselves. And as that linkage gets, you know, deconditioned, that's a place of greater freedom. And then also it's a place where we're no longer so heavily conditioned by the content of those thoughts. Sometimes thinking can have a lot of negative self-talk, and all kinds of, you know, or we go into imagination, thoughts, imagination about anticipating terrible things are going to happen, and so it can be quite a big impact to live under the assault of all these frightening scenarios of what will happen. And if there's a habit of having those thoughts, it can be tremendous stress in our system to have it over and over again. And so to slowly, compassionately, begin to kind of de-link these things. And not, you know, have a thought, but don't feel like it's automatically connected to who we are. To separate it. And then slowly that linkage gets, that de-linkage gets stronger and stronger, that gap. And then it's possible to have a thought, anticipating some frightening future, and just see it as a thought that arises, and that may or may not be true, but there doesn't have to be any influence of that thought back on our heart, back on our rest of our system, on our mind. It's just a thought. And so this ability to let go and come back, let go and come back, and you might have to do it 10,000 times to really kind of begin feeling or seeing or experiencing the weakening of it and the separation from it in a way that gives you some freedom. But I suspect that 10,000 times, the way that our minds, if your minds are at all like mine sometimes, that you can probably get through that in a couple of days. you know, because it happens so often, the mind goes off and come back. And so then it becomes easier and easier to have continuity of practice. You keep showing up for the present moment. And the sooner you let go of the thought, the sooner you are in the present moment. Come back and be here. Come here. And so there's this continuity of practice, the steadiness of practice. And holding steady here is a part of what kind of begins letting things kind of wash off and not be caught by it. I was thinking about this a little bit today because in the most recent issue of the Journal of American Medical Association, which I suppose is a very prestigious journal, right? Is that pretty prestigious? No, you don't care about American. She's from Canada. So on this side of the border, this is what they're saying. The latest study, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, assessed the value of mindfulness-based stress reduction. So there's hundreds and hundreds of articles like this and research on the benefits of MBSR. But to make it into this journal is pretty good. And cognitive behavioral therapy, a form of psychotherapy that helps reframe negative thoughts and is considered an evidence-based treatment for chronic pain. And this study was about chronic pain. And it's, the headlines is, for chronic low back pain, mindfulness can beat painkillers. The 342 participants, most of whom had suffered back pain weekly for at least the past year, were offered either 8 weekly sessions of mindfulness training, 8 sessions of cognitive behavioral therapy, or to keep doing what they've been doing. Of those who did the mindfulness training, which included meditation and yoga instruction and CDs they could use at home, 43.6% reported a meaningful reduction in pain 26 weeks later. In the cognitive behavioral therapy, 44.9% reported significant improvements. That's compared to 26.6% in the usual care group. And it's despite the fact that most people didn't attend all 8 sessions of the program. That's kind of interesting. Anyway, cognitive therapy was slightly better than mindfulness, so please stay for the retreat. It's only slightly better. But it sounds like you don't have to show up for all the sittings to get an improvement. Then this man, Daniel Churkin, says, I've been doing research on back pain for 30 years. He's a senior investigator of some research institute. And he said, the biggest revolution has been the understanding that it's not just a physical problem with physical solutions. And here is a great word. I never heard this word before. Maybe you have. It's a biophysico-social problem. Biopsychosocial. That's what I said wrong, right? Biopsychosocial problem. So one-third of that is biological, and two-thirds of it has to do with what our minds do, either individually. I guess that's a psycho part. I guess we're all psychos. And the social part, which, you know, that's our extension of our minds and our connection to others and all that. And some of those problems, back problems, come about because they're told there's no medical cure for chronic back pain. It puts people in a situation where they get afraid, they get stressed, they're tired, and they're irritable. Unfortunately, these people have not found healthcare providers to be very helpful. They feel alone. They feel that their pain is not being validated. The lack of evidence, lack of effective medical treatment frustrates doctors too and helps fuel the explosion of opiate prescribing of chronic pain. And so they're saying that opiates are less effective than mindfulness and cognitive therapy. So it's quite powerful. You know, I have to be very careful not to promise all kinds of health cures from mindfulness. But it's quite powerful because of the tremendous role that our mind has. Mind is a powerful, powerful, beautiful instrument. And our thoughts and our beliefs and all that can have a big impact on how we feel and what we do. And so sometimes if you change how you think about things, you have a new perspective on something, things get better. If you have a different perspective, things can get worse. It's not too uncommon for some people to have physical pain, and they go to the doctor, and if the doctor is compassionate and caring and gives them the diagnosis, the pain goes away, just knowing what it is. And maybe it even helps with the parents, because when my son was 8 months old, he had a broken collarbone, and we didn't know it for many hours. He was in an accident, and he was told he was okay, and he started crying at night, and it was terrible, crying, for inconsolable. And so we went back to the emergency. We went to the doctor first thing in the morning, And the doctor said, oh, it's a broken clavicle. And when he said that, my son stopped crying. Now, I don't think he knew English yet. So I don't know, you know, if he was connected to his parents. And his parents relaxed. Oh, now we know what it is. And maybe that was enough for him to kind of, oh, you know, my parents are relaxed, then it's okay for me. You know, that's the social part, perhaps. Biopsychosocial, you know. We're so connected to each other. It's remarkable. So in mindfulness practice, we're beginning to track and notice what happens in our mind. What are we doing? And what's the self-talk? And what's our how are we relating to what's happening? And beginning to be the custodian of how we relate to the world around us, how we relate to the mind inside of us. And the practice is offered as something very radical. And so to appreciate the radicalness of it, I think it helps to know that the radical teaching is not supposed to be the last word, that all kinds of other approaches are dismissed or something. The radical teaching is that if you kind of really can stop and look deeply into your own mind, you can find a way for a radical freedom of mind, a radical liberation of heart, where the mind or the awareness or the heart, in relationship to suffering and happiness, can become independent of most of the influences that affect it now, most of the conditions that have impacted. That there's a radical way in which there's a separation from that, how these conditions automatically influence us, or automatically we react to it. And there's an ease and an openness and a freedom that can happen in that space. To help with this, the mindfulness practice is also kind of reframing or redirecting where we think it's important to bring our attention. And I want to give you an example that I like to do. So I'm holding this striker, the bell striker, and if this striker is really important for me, then I might really focus on the importance of it. You know, a good Dharma teacher has a good striker, and you know, my reputation's at stake. You know, and I think this is a great striker, and I want to make sure you guys see it and notice it. And you know, I'm really focusing on that fact that it's so important, the striker. Or I can focus on my desire and attachment to the striker, and I can really notice inside that it's so painful to be so dependent on the striker. And I can notice, you know, my thoughts and beliefs around the striker and my self-talk around the striker. No, that's inner work. But between the striker and my thoughts about it is my grasping of it. And it's possible to miss the grasping, not to notice how we're relating to it. Because either we're so focused on the thing that we're thinking about or concerned with, or we're so concerned about our own inner world in relationship to it. But a third part of the equation is how we hold it. And if I pay attention to how I hold it, I might notice my knuckles are going white. It hurts to hold it this way. And I might not have noticed it was hurting because I was so connected, either focusing on the thing or my thoughts about it. But once I start noticing how much it hurts to hold, then a kind of a natural movement is to open my hand, and I can hold it this way. I can still hold it, and you guys can see it even better, so you know how great I am. I can hold it lightly and openly like this, and it's so much more easeful and nice to do this. So with mindfulness practice, part of what we're doing also is bringing our attention a variety of different places towards a variety of different things, not to the thing that's happening, and not only to the inner world, but how we're holding all this stuff, what our relationship to it is. So if we're having some kind of frequent thoughts that keep coming back over and over again, and we just let go of them, there's a third thing. There's me, there's a thought, and then it's how I relate to the thoughts. And there might be a tremendous interest, a fascination. There might be horror. I might be disturbed by the thoughts. I might have judgments about the thoughts. I might have an unconscious belief that all thoughts should be believed. Or I might grant the thoughts a lot of authority, Or I might invest a lot of importance in how thoughts, thinking things through, is going to solve all my problems. So all those things are how we relate to the thoughts. We believe them quickly, easily. We give them authority. We invest importance in them. We cling to them. We hold on to them. We resist them. We push them away. All those are ways that it's possible to feel and know, and then to open the fist of the mind, and then we can hold those thoughts more lightly. And then if they're important to think, maybe we can think them. If we don't need them right now, we can let go of them. And so we're helping to create that space between us and the thought, us and the object, us, the conditions around us, and how we react or respond to those conditions. So it's a kind of turning our attention to the present moment and start feeling what goes on, feeling how we cling and how we hold, how we resist. And that's an important part of the information we're taking in. And we start feeling how it's uncomfortable to do some of the things we do. If we tune in to the subjective experience of what it's like to be doing this. So it can be as simple, as innocent, as going down for the next meal and standing in that long line, and you ended up in the back of the line. And you have important places to go and things to do here at the retreat center. And so you don't want to wait in a long line. And so you start feeling impatient and you're kind of peering over people's shoulders to make sure there's enough food there, and you're counting how many, you know, broccoli pieces are left to make sure that there's some for you, and you're crowding the person in front of you. And so what's your subjective experience of that? If you stop focusing on the cauliflower and focus on what it's like to be thinking about the food, you feel that impatience, that eagerness, that kind of desire and fear connected to the food. It feels pretty uncomfortable. And perhaps it's more comfortable just to relax and stand there and just to breathe and not be concerned about the food. Probably you can't do anything about it anyway if you're in the back of the line. Just, you know, sit there and relax. And so only by feeling how uncomfortable it was do you really get the information you need to have that this isn't working. I don't want to do this. So it's not a policy. It's not like you think, oh, here I am greedily thinking about the food and wanting to get it, and I'm supposed to be a good Buddhist and you're not supposed to do this. That's just more of the old way. But the new way in mindfulness is you notice the discomfort. You really notice the impact and what's going on. And that information can help releasing the grip, the holding. Then we have faith that it's okay to release the grip. We don't have to hold everything so tight. We can have an open hand, an open mind, an open heart. Just be here with us in a simple way. It's better for us. There's not so much pain and stress. So we start having faith, confidence in this possibility. The continuity of this, and knowing this is a possibility, can bring gladness. Wow, I know something here. I know that I don't have to always be caught. I don't have to always be tight and restricted or into the experience I have. I can bring mindfulness to it. I can bring non-reactive attention to it. I can insert attention, a clear, honest awareness, into the middle of what's happening to begin separating out my entanglement with it, with the experience itself. And it's really good to learn to develop confidence in that and the value of that in really small, simple areas, places where it's easy to do. And so, for example, if that line for meals is an easy place for you, practice there. And so by the time you get to the front of the line, you're like the most chilled, relaxed, you know, line stander in California, you know, because you really took that on. Maybe that was easy. If it's difficult, then that's not the place to do it. But maybe there's some other place you can do it. And start getting a sense and a feel and confidence that in small places you can do this, bring mindfulness to the situation. And in bring mindfulness, you're not caught in it so much. You kind of make a separation between the conditions and your response to things. And then over time, that becomes stronger and stronger. And so the continuity of practice, holding steady with a practice, is a way of not so easy, it's a tool to help you not so easily get pulled into your thoughts and reactions. So hold steady with the breath. Hold steady with being in the present. Hold steady with your steps. Don't easily leave. So there's some kind of commitment, some kind of devotion, some kind of wholeheartedness. Hold steady. Just be with that. And if that means that the holding steady allows you to do two or three steps more in the walking meditation before you wander off, and it doesn't seem like much, two or three steps. Two or three steps is fantastic. That's two or three steps more than you did before. And slowly begin to train the mind to give yourself over to what you have in hand here, something good and healthy, and you're less and less pulled into or reacting to all the different things that go on around us. And that continuity of practice is what tends to bring joy in the practice. Gladness comes from knowing you have a practice, knowing you have a path to practice, knowing you're connected to teachings that really work, and having some inspired trust and confidence can bring this kind of, oh, this is nice, I'm delighted, I'm lucky, I'm fortunate. It's kind of the basic appreciation of what we have. And, you know, being here at a retreat center, I've been on retreat centers and been miserable, and know from firsthand experience how difficult it is to notice the good fortune you have to be at a retreat center. And I know that I've been so miserable that I know that it can just be painful for the teacher to say, you think about the good fortune you have. So I won't say it. But I sure want to. But I can separate out the desire and what I do just enough. So some basic gladness, basic appreciation for what you have. And then with that gladness, that's a condition for giving yourself over to the practice more wholeheartedly. I can't underscore how wholeheartedness is an important condition for this. And you might consider today, in your practice today, could you have been more wholehearted in the practice today? Could you have given yourself in a good, heartfelt way, more fully into what you did? Or did you go for too many cups of tea when you didn't need it? Or did you, I don't know, you know, you just kind of, you know, you just kind of gave yourself over to too many, for too long, daydreams. One of the little things that some people do on retreats, they've been practicing for a while, it's, you know, some a little bit uncomfortable, they feel like they've been doing good effort maybe, and they go to some sitting and say, well, you know, I deserve a break. And I have this really good fantasy waiting. So I'm going to just spend a little bit of time because, you know, take a break and go into fantasy. And maybe that's a good break. Maybe you needed a break. But maybe it's not being wholehearted. It's kind of like being half-hearted. So I want to read you a story of being wholehearted in difficult circumstances. And I don't know if this is a true story, I think it certainly represents a very true insight that this mindfulness practitioner had in difficult circumstances. And so this was written by a prisoner at St. Quentin Prison who practices mindfulness. So this inmate wrote, "My night was like any other night. It was 3 p.m., time for close custody count. All prisoners have institutional counts wherein they count each prisoner's body to ensure no one is missing or has escaped. Not being there for count is considered a serious violation. The officer came to our cell and called my bunkie's name, after which my bunkie gave his last two digits of his prison number. The same went for me. Half an hour later, A neighbor comes to my cell and said they were paging me downstairs. I had not heard them calling for me. I went down to the podium, and the cops said to me, "Why were you not in your cell for count?" And I told them, "I was in my cell for count, as I have been every day and night for 12 years. And I have numerous neighbors that can verify that." It did not matter what I said. The cops told me to not do it again. And I am like, whatever. Which you don't say to a correctional officer at San Quentin. Whatever. 2 days go by, and I find out that the sergeant gave me a write-up, a violation. I'm thinking, okay, I truly am not guilty of this, and I have many witnesses who will say the same. However, at the hearing, the cop that counted said he looked in the cell 2 times and I was not there. It did not matter what I said or how many people I had who would say the same, because I was found guilty and given 40 hours of extra duty, extra work. I said to myself, screw this. I am not going to do the work. This is so unfair. I did nothing wrong, and these guys are wrong about this. I watched that count cop count me, and he did not look up from his count board once. His eyes never left that board. I filed a complaint against the officer. That is the last thing I wanted to do, but I was not wrong about this. They were. I felt bitter about being ordered to do those 40 hours of extra duty. In a phone call, I spoke to my mother about it, and she wondered if I could perhaps just take it, and regardless of the circumstance and the injustice of it, see if I could do what would ultimately be best for me. She said she would accept what I decide, but if I could, to act respectfully. I reckoned if I refused to do the work, even though it came about unjustly, I would be guilty in their eyes. I chose to do the work anyway. I have always prided myself with doing exceptional work, and I was desperately looking to find my pride in this situation, somewhere, no matter what. So not only did I do the work, I did the best possible job I could do. I was asked to shine up this brass fire hydrant. Though I still felt resentful about those 40 hours of extra duty, I set off to shine up this hydrant, and I really got into the job. As a result, this hydrant started shining very brightly. As the sun caught it, I could see my face in it, and I noticed I was smiling from ear to ear. I began to laugh out loud for no reason other than enjoying that moment and seeing the result of my work. By putting all my conscious effort into shining up this fire hydrant, I had become bigger than the unfairness that led me to my assignment. I do not know how long I was at it, but when I was done, that hydrant, it looked like the prettiest thing in the whole prison, kinda like a small lighthouse standing proudly in an ocean of concrete, calling out on how to steer, on how to move through this place. I realized I was shining too, and it hasn't left me. Many people commented on that hydrant all week, wondering how come that thing gives off so much light all of a sudden. I just smiled. And signed the Birdman. That's his nickname in prison. I met him this year, the Birdman. Nice man. And so an injustice. And he decided to give himself wholeheartedly anyway into the activity of polishing his hydrant. Perhaps your breathing is your hydrant. Perhaps your mindfulness is your hydrant. Or you may be the cloth that you're going to polish it with. To give yourself over fully to some activity is a beautiful thing to do. Something begins to open up. Something begins to happen when we give ourselves fully to this one thing that we're doing, without being fragmented, without being pulled off left and right in thoughts and concerns and reactions and judgments, without constantly evaluating, how am I doing right, doing wrong, there's something quite wonderful about decoupling ourselves from so many of the common mental patterns and thoughts and reactions that we have, the habits we have, and giving ourselves over fully to this one activity. And letting all so much of the stuff just fall along the side, the boat. Keep hold steady, just let it kind of fall. And this, and I would say this man here, if, you know, he was a boat, so many things just fell right off as he gave himself fully for this one activity. And if you're practicing mindfulness, you don't have to worry too much that you're denying parts of yourself. Because as you give yourself fully to the present moment with mindfulness, the things that you need to address will sooner or later come front and center right in front of you. So then you give yourself fully to that, and then it becomes much simpler, the thing. So you might well up with tremendous anger and rage suddenly, out of the blue. Where did that come from? You look at your wristwatch and say, right on time. I guess that's what's supposed to happen now. And then you give yourself wholeheartedly, not over to the anger, you don't give yourself to it, but rather wholeheartedly to being present for it, for seeing it, for recognizing it, but so wholeheartedly you're with it that there's not a lot of judging and thinking what it means and who is noticing and what am I supposed to be doing and what should I do with my life and all the anger. We can get kind of layers and layers of kind of concerns on top of it. But mindfulness has a lot to do about keeping it really simple. And it's a beautiful thing to just, in this safe kind of environment of sitting and walking meditation, to allow the energy of anger just to move through us and be wholeheartedly present for it without adding a lot of extra layers of reactions and thoughts and beliefs and all that. Same thing with pain. Not all pain, but some of the discomforts we have, there's also an art to turning us, giving ourselves over to really be present for that in such a way that we're really there for it, that a lot of the extras that we add, the psychosocial aspects of pain, some of them begin to fall off to the side. They're not there. And then we can maybe separate the psychosocial from the biological aspects of pain. But, a percentage of our struggle with pain has to do with the psychosocial aspects of it, our beliefs, our reactions, our thoughts, all kinds of things. And so this giving ourselves wholehearted, just be present for it in a very simple way. And then practicing continuity, just staying with it, staying there present, staying, coming back. And since I evoke the idea of pain, any time that you suspect, even lightly, that you might be injuring yourself from the pain, change your posture, if you have any hint like that. But it's possible to have lots of physical pain and there's no danger signals in it. But if you have any danger signals, it's better to err on the side of moving and changing. And then the other thing about pain is if you have pain when you sit and the pain persists for more than 5 minutes or so after you get up to walk around, then you want to be really careful that you try to be more careful how you sit and try not to have that particular pain reappear if you can. Or if it continues like this and continues into the walking period, at some point you might want to come talk to a teacher. But generally, pain can be a wonderful place to practice. And I've practiced with a lot of pain, and I think a lot of the benefits, not all, but some of the benefits I got from practice was learning how to be with pain and decoupling my reactivity with it. Learning to be present with pain, discomfort, and kind of like have an open hand to it rather than grasping something, gripping something, pushing something away. And one of the things that I've seen is that when I have a reaction to pain, I saw it most clearly when I, in my early sittings, where in Zen we weren't allowed to move, and I had a tremendous amount of knee pain. And my favorite strategy with knee pain was self-pity. And when I had self-pity, I noticed after a while that I would tighten my little muscles around my knee a little bit more. And if I let go of my self-pity, those little muscles would relax and the pain wouldn't be so bad. So what's more important? To hold on to the self-pity or to have relief in the knee? None of you come up, none of you saying anything obvious, so I guess it's a big dilemma. That the self-pity, you know, sometimes we identify so strongly with our ideas about self. And this continuity of practice is one of the great keys, supports, for allowing a lot of this extra stuff that goes on to not have so much power over us. To stay with it. And then, as the prisoner, story of the inmate, there's something actually physiological that happens in our whole system when we give ourselves wholeheartedly over to something like just being with the breath, just being with the steps, just being in the present moment. It's possible that serotonins are being released, but there's something that begins happening that a certain kind of physiological joy begins to kind of bubble up from inside. And it's not a joy that comes from evaluating something, like, oh, this is a really great thing that's happening, but it's a joy that I feel comes from the joy of engagement, the joy of just, oh, being present for what is, being, you know, and everything harmonizes there with it. And there can start to be this kind of sense of lightness and joy as the heaviness of our mind settles away, as we're not carrying these big boulders anymore, as we begin not being so swept to left and right, the boat's not being turned one direction or the other by the wind, but we hold steady as we go. I know that retreat practice can be a challenge and difficult, and sometimes I believe that the more difficult and challenging it is, the more valuable it is, the more we can learn about ourselves. And the things that really kind of create a big impact on us inside usually represents that something really deep in our hearts that they're really good to address and to meet and work our way through. But I also want to say that you're allowed to feel delight, joy, appreciation, happiness. And I didn't realize that when I first years of practice. And so I made no room for it. And at times when a little bit of joy started arising, I just kind of like, one more thing to let go of. Yeah. You know, like almost like dismissing it, like, not that. Let's get serious here. And but it turns out that having a certain degree of well-being, of joy or happiness or lightness, gladness, appreciation, is kind of leavening for the practice. It kind of helps the mind and heart soften, helps kind of create the space that becomes easier to open the grip of the fist. And so you might, as you go through this retreat, when you start feeling, to notice that if there is some delight, appreciation, joy that might arise, no matter how weak it might be, you might consider appreciating it, recognizing it. And it's similar to the beautiful story that Adrian said yesterday about the bus driver. And how, you know, Adrian said, you just made my day, and the bus driver said, you made my day for recognizing what I'd done. There's something about the act of recognition that can feed the things that are wholesome. And so we don't expect joy all the time, and you don't want to feel bad about yourself if it's not here, but there might be more occasions to notice and appreciate the moment than you've availed yourself so far. And part of the holding steady and simple and being concentrated on just what you're doing in the moment and letting so many things fall off the side of the boat and not trouble you, it kind of begins to clear the eyes or clear the senses. So things kind of become clear and crisper. And then you might go out to the building here and you hear the birds. And it's just, wow, I didn't know there were birds here. Oh, but they just arrived, I guess. That's nice. Or you might notice the sun is out. Normally, you know, the clouds are not in the sky, but in you. But you notice, oh, look at that. And it's that simple kind of appreciation, that simple things can make a big difference for leavening the heart and supporting us and helping us, inspiring us to be wholehearted, to give ourselves over to this practice, one step at a time, one breath at a time. May you polish your fire hydrant, no matter what the injustice of the situation. So let's take a minute or two to kind of recompose, to be back in the kind of more mindfulness mode.